Hello, friends, and welcome to season two of the Ended Records podcast. This is your host, Ozzy Ronsberger. This season, we will talk in depth about our next release, the reissues of the Better Than a Thousand albums, Just One and Value Driven. Our first guest is singer Ray Capo. Before fronting Better Than a Thousand, Ray, also known under his spiritual name Raghunath, sang in the legendary straight edge band Youth of Today and later invented a new subgenre called Krishna Core with his band Shelter. He is now a well known yoga teacher and lives on a farm in upstate New York with his family. So, hi, Ray. How are you doing today?
Hey, Wazzy. How are you, brother?
Ray, we are here today to talk about the reissues of the two Better Than a Thousand albums, Value Driven and Just One. And before we get into the details, do you remember when you met your collaborators, Graham Land and Ken Olden, for the very first time?
Graham, I knew because he used to go to the temple when he was really young, like 17, when I lived in Washington, D.C., when I was a monk in the Hare Krishna temple. And Graham used to come and visit there. And so Graham came and started helping me write the first Shelter single, which was Sharanagati. Graham was one of the original writers of that. And Graham was always in and out of Shelter, even though he didn't really play on any records except that single. But he's toured with Shelter a bunch of times. Ken, how did I meet Ken? I can't remember how I met Ken. But I think just because Shelter was around and Ken was a fan of Youth of Today and we played in DC, Shelter played a lot in DC somehow. And oh, and he happened to live a few, which is very peculiar because no one does that anymore, but he lived like a few streets away from Graham. So those guys were old friends and they were in Battery together. Shelter was getting bigger and bigger at that time. And then we released Beyond Planet Earth, which was sort of tanked as a record. And it was sort of very, very far away from Youth of Today sound or a hardcore sound. Those guys wrote a very thrashy record and wanted me to sing on it. And I thought it would be cool to do. So that's how we did Just One. And then after Just One did pretty good, and it was happening simultaneously to Shelter releasing, or perhaps just after Shelter release Beyond Planet Earth.
Like we are talking about 1997 right now.
1997-ish, yeah.
Where were you personally at that point? Like you were not a monk anymore, if I remember correctly, right?
No
more dhoti robes, no more shika, you know, the Krishna ponytail at that point? Like,
you know, it was a sort of a time in my life. It was sort of a time in my life where I was just sort of to like going through like a second growth and trying to refine myself. I'm one of these people that like I dive into stuff, I get very serious about it, and then I attract a bunch of people to it, and then I don't like the way that things are within that community. You know, like when I got into straight edge, there was no straight edge kids. There was not a straight edge scene. It was very like a bold statement to be straight edge then. When I got into Krishna, there was no Krishna hardcore. Like the Cro-Mags were Krishna hardcore, but they weren't like monks. I wanted to become like an Orthodox monk. And so whenever there was a scene of something, I ended up just sort of like stepping back from it to re-question all my thoughts. So I was at a point where like I stepped out of monk life, started to rethink my identity. And truthfully, sort of at that Better Than a Thousand time, I was just sort of like rethinking, like, what is my identity in this world? And that's sort of where I was at. I mean, I was still into bhakti and Krishna, but I just sort of separated myself from an ashram in particular. Graham was already like living in the ashram with us at that time. Uh-huh. Matter of fact, he was in the ashram in New York City. That's when Shelter lived in New York City. We lived in the Brooklyn Temple, and we had just put out Mantra, and then we put out Beyond Planet Earth. And so Graham was living with us when we wrote that. And same with Adam from H2O.
Was the infamous Shelter van accident that you guys had, before that or in between those two albums?
I can't remember. I'm really hazy on that. But it was it was after Beyond Planet Earth.
Okay. Because that was like a significant event in your life, I assume.
Yeah,
right?
We drove off the side of a mountain, you know, on tour. Actually at the beginning of a tour. And so it sort of like ruined the, you know, when you do things like on a bigger record label, a lot of my records I put out were independent labels or in my own labels. And then when we got on a bigger label, Roadrunner, you know, there's, you know, bigger companies that give a big push. You know, you put out a record, they have a bunch of press set up for you, they send you out on tour. And it ruined the whole push of that record because we stopped touring. We couldn't go anywhere because we were all in the hospital or recovering. And so I think that's at the time those guys approached me to sing. My injuries weren't super bad. I just had I couldn't walk, but it was like a very, very bad sprain. I couldn't walk for like 7 months or something.
Did you name the band? Because if I remember correctly, it was based on a Buddhist poem, right?
Yeah, Graham named the band.
Do you remember what like the appeal of the name was to you? Like the background, what it meant to you?
We both like these. I think it's from the Dhammapada, which is like a Buddhist literature, which we both thought was a cool book. I mean, I still think it's a cool book.
Recording the Just One album, the way Ken and Graham explained it to me is like they wanted to do a demo. And then you got involved and they only had this really small time window of a few days. So they just added 5 or 6 more songs to the demo. And then you came in and just, you know, blew through the recording. Do you remember anything about recording Just One back then?
All I remember is those guys did most of the work. All I remember is, God, where did we record that?
Atlanta with Issa.
Oh, in Atlanta. Yeah. No, I just drove straight to Atlanta. It was one of those things. It was one of those better than 1,000. We just sort of like, and it was actually quite a relief because it's how I was used to recording stuff. Like one of my more popular records I ever recorded was Break Down the Walls or Can't Close My Eyes. I mean, Can't Close My Eyes. I think the total recording budget was like $80. You know, I'm dead serious. I did it in 4 hours and I whipped through every song first or second take. And so that was my style. And then when we got into like on a real recording, like Mantra was like a real recording. And, you know, the record company spending so much money to record these records. And it was like really, because I'm not really, you know, I'm not a singer, believe it or not. I'm a singer of a band, but I'm not like a real trained singer. So for me, it was always like, always precarious and awkward to be in the studio. And I never really enjoyed it. And those were really drawn out to record those records. And same with Beyond Planet Earth. These records took forever. For me, forever is like a month to record a record or 2 months to record a record. And I mean, truthfully, that's what most bands do when they like big professional bands, when they record records, they take months, sometimes longer than a month. But for me, I was so like sort of into DIY. We put it out ourselves. We book our own tours. It was very sort of like, okay, you know, I was growing up. I was growing up and I guess this is what you do now. And, you know, I had a bunch of friends that were also becoming professional musicians, you know, getting signed to major labels. And it was a really interesting time in the 90s because everybody went from DIY bands to becoming like major label bands. And so it was actually an incredible relief to just do our own thing again and just record it at a friend's studio at our time and I went down there and I whipped it off. And the second record, Value Driven, same thing. We did it in Ken's house. And for me, that was like business as usual, you know, and you could just, that's how you record. That's how we recorded stuff. And there was no budget. We just did it.
So that's what felt natural to you compared to what happened on Mantra and Beyond Planet Earth at that point.
Well, that's what I was used to. I'm not saying it's bad to do it in a professional way. And sometimes if your goal is to get played on, you know, on the radio and things like that, it's useful to have a clean recording. But like I said, I'm, and if you know me, I'm not like a I'm not a polished musician by any And so I'm much more comfortable taking it very seriously, but sort of lightly at the same time.
You take the message seriously. You take the process a little bit more lightly.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it.
So at that point, you obviously signed to Roadrunner, which is one of the biggest, you know, record companies of the world at that point, right?
They were the biggest, I think the biggest independent record company. It means it was owned by one person.
So at that point, you know, they invested tons of money. You're in the studio recording, you know, Beyond Planet Earth, which is supposed to, you know, take the next step for you guys.
Yeah.
How are they feeling about you starting this punk side project?
I don't think they were so happy about it because they felt like it was a diversion of their investment. You know, they're making an investment in you. But I think because we went through that accident, that car accident, they were a little bit more... I can't remember if there was a big issue. If I was them, I would have had a huge issue with it. But it took me on tour a few times, and I think it sort of put the Shelter. I think Shelter was really trying to refigure out who we were in the world. I mean, when we started Shelter, you know, I started it with all monks. You know what I mean? And then when I left becoming a monk, I had to like sort of like redefine myself. So I think we were all at a place where we're sort of like, who are we? How do we fit in this world? Truthfully, I can't remember exactly where my head was at that time. I'm piecing together these points. I never journaled about it. Sorry.
So when at that point, obviously the internet is not really a thing, you know? So I remember the Better Than a Thousand record landed in my lap. A friend gave it to me. I've never heard of it before. There was no message boards or anything in Bavaria, you know.
Right.
So a complete surprise. I get this thing and I put it on and I was blown away. But the first thing I noticed is Rick Capo is cursing again.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like there's fucks on this record.
I know. By the way, I don't curse any longer for the most part. I think I was like experimenting with, you know, it's a weird thing because you got to understand when I was 22, I became an Orthodox monk. And then when you leave that for 7 years, and when you leave that and try to, and the whole world has changed around you in that 7 years. Like I missed out completely on pop culture. I missed out on the first Bush administration. I missed out on grunge. There was no, you know, I missed out on all, you know, when I went into the ashram to live in an ashram. Everybody wore tight legged jeans. While I lived in the ashram, the fashions changed that everyone wore stovepipe gigantic jeans. So it's like when I walked out of the ashram, I didn't even know how to dress anymore. I missed out on culture. I missed out on The Simpsons. I missed out on Seinfeld. You know, this was like a huge part of American culture. And I was like, truthfully, I was like a little lost on trying to figure out who I was in the material world. And so I end up resorting back to old habits, old thoughts, old language. And I think it took years to find sort of like a balance between how do you, you know, retain those good things that you learn in ashram and apply it to life instead of being like a pendulum swinging from one side to another. I mean, you got to understand, even as a monk, I never listened to music. I just chose that I'll write music, but I'm not going to listen to other music because the theory is the sounds that you put in your consciousness affect your thoughts. And so then hearing that, I was like, okay, I'm not going to put any sounds that aren't going to assist my thoughts in my mind. Yet I'm still in a band. I mean, of course, within reason, if someone gave me a demo tape, I'd listen to it, but I didn't go out and actively pursue listening to all the 90s hardcore bands. Because it's just not I was very fixed in what I was, you know, working on my self, you know, development. But in that sense, it was very peculiar to write music because, you know, usually when you write music, you're influenced by other music. But I really cut myself off from the world, even though I was in a band playing and maybe even touring and traveling the world and meeting with more people than the average people did. I mean, considering I was living an isolated existence, I was in countries all over the world, and I was meeting with thousands of people per day, but still I kept myself almost like in a, you know what a snow globe is, one of those like bubbles. Oh, yeah. I kept myself like sort of in a bubble. So at the time of Better Than 1,000, I'm like sort of like broke out of that bubble, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, who am I in this world now? I've missed a big chunk of it. Then these old friends of mine came and said, hey, we wrote this record. What kind of music, what kind of lyrics would you write for this? What is your persona going to be? Who are you going to be, et cetera?
Very interesting.
That was an interesting time of life.
I can imagine. When was the time, when do you think you figured out who you are and how you can balance those two things then?
I feel like the balance happened to me when I got married. It helped me sort of like settle. It helped me grow. I think probably a lot of people who are married can say that. It helped them like sort of settle down or have a kid, especially when you have a child, because when you have a child, there's much less of a focus on your needs and you're focusing on the child's needs. And it sort of takes you out of like a sort of self-absorption, which even as a monk, you're sort of absorbed. You're worried about your self-growth and your self-edification. And once you have a child, it's really off of you and on them. So I married a lady who had two little boys that I raised. And I think it helped me find a grip in the material world and a place in my spiritual life, and to get to regulate my spiritual life a little better as well. It's like it's a balancing act. It's like, suppose you're on one of those slack lines. You know what a slack line is?
Oh yeah, between the trees. Oh yeah.
You put it between the trees, and someone just like pulls that thing and snaps it while you're on it. You got to just sort of find your balance, and that's sort of, I think, leaving an ashram was sort of like, how are you going to relate now to this world? So yeah, I think it took me some years to find that balance.
Did you, when you moved out of the ashram, where did you move to?
I lived in Brooklyn Heights.
And Porcel was still in the ashram at that point, or did he also move out at the same time?
He got into it a few years later than me. And I think he stayed as a monk for a year longer, but I think he was sort of like, he wasn't settled doing it. It was hard. It's hard to be a monk and be in a touring professional band. You know what I mean? In the old days when we were monks, we were just like, we'd go on tour and then we'd go to India and we'd go on tour and then we'd stay in the ashram. We'd like balance it out. We didn't go too much out there without rechecking in. But once we got signed, there was a greater push towards, you know, material success. Mm-hmm. And that's natural once you're, you know,
I mean, there's just more options. 100%.
There's 100% more options. No signed band. They don't want you like living in a closet, you know, and I had to start thinking about how am I going to make a living? Who am I in this world? You know, I have no actual talent. You know, I didn't go to university. I traded in the university to live in an ashram. So I have no like skills. I'm not a brain surgeon. I'm not an accountant, whatever. All I knew was music, really.
It's still impressive that you wrote such eclectic music while being completely removed from the world, don't you think?
It is pretty interesting.
Like, where is that music coming from, and how did music that was written in such a vacuum connecting to so many people?
No idea, my friend. No idea.
I mean, it's great songs, but do you think the message on top of it helped? Or just a combination of both?
The music was like, right. By the way, we're diverting to a shelter interview right now, but I'm okay
We can always go back.
Yeah, it was a real mixed bag of all musical influences I've ever listened to. And I sort of liked that about Shelter, because it was very unpredictable. There was no set sound. Whereas Better Than 1,000, Youth of Today, there was a classic sound. So you can trace back the origins within parameters of the sounds that we created. And the funny thing was, if you really think about it, Better Than 1,000 was only 10 years later than Youth of Today. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a long amount of time, but it seemed like decades back then. It seemed like Youth of Today was decades. But now when you look back, it's like, yeah, that was whatever. That was 30 years ago.
That backs up my theory that punk years are like dog years. You know, it's what I mean? True. It moves so fast because it's so youth driven, you know what I mean? And the fluctuation of people coming in and out is so high that it's literally everything can change within 2 years.
I like that. Punk years are like dog years. Sounds good.
Bringing it back to Better Than 1,000 a little bit. So you're value driven. You're literally recording in a bathroom. Is that correct?
Well, the vocals were in the bathroom, but the guitar amps were in the bedroom. But yeah, but Ken had all the equipment at his house, so we just did it there.
That's the punkest thing on the planet.
Yeah, it's pretty punk.
Recording at the
punk. And it sounds pretty good. Youth of Today went to Chung King to record that album, and that was one of the worst recordings we ever made, like ever. You know, some people love that record, but ask anybody in the band. That was like a disaster.
And that was like the most professional high-end studio you could get, right?
Well, at that point, because they did all the Def Jam bands. They did, you know, Beastie Boys, Slayer, Danzig, Run DMC, Jam Master J, L Cool J, I think.
Yeah.
So I think they did a lot of these, all the Def Jam bands. But so, yeah, it was considered the best, but they gave us some B-rate producer. I don't know why it came out so damn bad.
Maybe because you also didn't like being in the studio and just didn't care at that point.
I have no clue. But I do know that I was happy with the way Value Driven. I actually really like that record.
I mean, it's a fantastic record and it has that spirit.
And truthfully, all of Better Than 1,000, especially that record, we just decided, you know what? I've been through these major labels. I'm going to do all this crap ourselves. And we just started putting out singles around the world, like Argentina, Spain. Where else did we do it? Sweden, Japan. We made a Japanese release of Value Driven. We toured all over. We toured South America. We toured Brazil. It was quite amazing, all the stuff that we were only a band for a short time, and we did. I mean, we toured the world many times. So we even went to Japan, although we all got what's it called? We get kicked out of a country, deported. We all got deported.
Oh yeah.
We flew from New York to Osaka to Fukuoka, and the record was out. The tour was there, and they said, "Where are your working papers?" They said, "Are you here on business or pleasure?" So half the band said pleasure and half the band said business. And it was like right out of like a sitcom. And they said, and the guy just said, "Okay, sit over there."
Oh my God. Who said pleasure and who said business? Do you remember?
I can't remember. We were just like blurting out the wrong thing at the same time. And they made us sit down and they said, "I'm sorry, you're getting deported."
And that is like, amazing.
I know. And then the guy wanted us to sneak in. I was like, I don't know. It was like a whole nightmare. We never snuck back in. I haven't been to Japan. Sadly, I haven't been to Japan since then.
Oh, so you think you're banned forever?
Perhaps.
Red flag.
Yeah. That was 20 years ago.
You might be able to get back in. Yeah. What I remember when you toured on that record, you came to Europe with Battery on that double bill. You also had a self-help CD at the merch table.
Yep.
What was that about?
Basically the similar things I do right now. You know, I've always been into sort of the same type of thing since I've been 20 years old.
Yep.
Yeah. It's just about sort of like getting your material and spiritual life together. But, you know, stuff is basically stuff I learned in an ashram, but tried to make it accessible to people who didn't necessarily want to join a religion or a church. But now, I mean, now it's like 25 years later and, you know, some of the best-selling authors are, you know, people like the Dalai Lama or Jay Shetty or all these people that have all this type of Eastern wisdom. And they're making it relevant to the world, you know? So it was sort of just that.
I mean, you guys were trailblazers at that point, right? Do you realize that when you look back, like you grabbed all those topics and talked about them 15 to 20 years before mainstream culture caught up?
I know. Even things like veganism and vegetarian, it just wasn't in the narrative or the wasn't in the conversation of people, what people were talking about, or clean living. Or it was, matter of fact, I was just reading a post on the SSD control Instagram, and they they posted Al Baril's lyrics about straight edge and smoking, and I was thinking, yeah, this is actually normal now. You're not allowed to smoke in public places, whereas back then it was incredibly common. You can smoke wherever you want. It's not a bad thing. If you got a problem with it, get over it. And back then it seemed so extreme. We seemed so extreme to talk about anything like a higher power or spirituality, so extreme. And now it's like, I mean, if you say you're like into bhakti yoga or yoga, it's like everybody is, or hell, or it's like, of course you are. Everybody is. It's like cool. We got into it. It was not only not cool. When I became a monk, I did it for all the noblest reasons I could have thought of in my life. It wasn't because I was getting a kickback or getting paid or getting, you know, it wasn't because my family, to make my parents proud or the people in the music scene proud of me. I did it because I really believed this stuff, and I was ostracized. People didn't like me. People threw meat at me. People made fun of me. People called me a loser. Magazines wrote bad articles about me, tried to publicly humiliate me. You know, it was sort of like I didn't do it to gain friends and, win over people. It's just because I believed in it. So it was one of these things that nowadays it's like cool. It's respectable. It's sort of like I can talk to people about it, and you can make a living from it, et cetera.
Do you think you started too early? Do you wish? No. Or do you think you reap the benefit?
Of course, I totally reap the benefit. Are you kidding? I might even be dead by now if it wasn't for it. Huh. And I know a lot of kids who did die. A lot of kids don't make it out of their 20s. They mix up with the wrong people. They get hooked on some drugs and they die. And a lot of people they take a real roundabout way. I've seen it happen to straight edge kids too. They get out of straight edge and they go like a slippery slope. They slide right down into some addictive habit that brings them to their knees. And they go through a whole very roundabout way to turn themselves on to a higher power through a 12-step program or something like that. So I'm totally grateful that I got into it at a young age. I mean, it might not have been the best thing for, you know,
financially.
I mean, if you think about it, I made money. I just was not attached to the money. So I just gave my money in charity, because it's not like I gave up everything. I was still in a successful, lucrative band. I started my own record company. I traveled the world. In one sense, I lived in isolation internally. But externally, I was more in the world than most people were, mm-hmm. You know?
At that point, like you said, like you released that record and then you became more active than ever, right? Like you toured the world. Like I've saw pictures of you play these huge festivals in Spain, Brazil, like South America. What Ken said yesterday is like how he couldn't believe it, how dedicated you actually were. He said you came off a 10-month or shelter tour and you jumped back into the van with better than 1,000.
Yeah, that's how we rolled back then.
Do you know what your motivation was? Can you remember? Because it couldn't be the money. Like you don't play in a hardcore band to get rich, right?
I think that was just what we were into. And that's sort of what was expected. And I'm not even saying I'm great because of it. Some people like myself, like Ken, like Graham, we can be on tour all year long and it's normal. Like sick of it all, like bands like H2O, these bands that go on tour like this, it takes a special type of person that can just pack up their life and live in a car. And not a lot of people can do that. Some people, even though they like look up to you and they think it's cool, and maybe they even want to be in a band, they lose it after 3 days. And I'm not putting them down. As a matter of fact, it's more normal to think it's weird, but there's certain people that are like born. I mean, you're one of them too. You're a tour manager. It's like our lives are weird. You know, we spend like, you know, 16 hours in a city and then pack up and do the same thing again. You go to 20 cities in 20 days and you interact with so many people and friends and fans in that city. And you develop sort of like a deep, almost instant depth in a relationship with them. And then you leave them and do the same thing over the next day and you revisit them. I mean, anyone I meet from any country, practically, if I'm meeting some person, they'll say, yes, I'm from, you know, Cologne, Germany. I'll be like, oh, Cologne, Germany. I've been there 20 times. And they're like, what? You've been to Cologne 20 times? Yeah, maybe more. I we've been to like the tiniest little villages that basically the whole world won't even visit. At least Americans won't visit, but, you know, but at the same time, you know, we didn't spend tons of time in those places. We spent a moment in those places. And it's a special beast. So for me to get back in the van tour, just sort of what we did, you know.
Do you think they prepped you like for what you're doing right now, like traveling all the time, teaching yoga or taking, you know, pilgrimages through India? Is that all based on what you learned back then?
It prepped me for being a monk, being in a band, that's for sure. and then living in a monastery also, that was just like normal. What it didn't prep me for was settling down. Because settling down means you settle down. And I'm sort of like always like, even still, I'm a yoga teacher, but I travel internationally and teach pretty much every weekend until the coronavirus hit.
So was settling down a problem for you when you did it?
I was a little ready to do it, but I don't know. It might be a karmic thing. Maybe my karma is just to travel because I travel more than I ever did right now. I was just talking to you before the show that I was supposed to be in Europe right now. I was on like a, you know, 2-week tour through Europe teaching, you know, and I traveled to Southeast Asia and teach. I traveled to all around America and teach, and I traveled to India twice a year and teach.
Ken mentioned something which I thought was interesting. He said that he thinks that you are somebody that needs change a lot. That means if something is too repetitive over a long period of time, you get bored with it. And that might be the reason why the band ended at some point, that it was just the same old. Is that actually a correct assumption?
I think with Better Than a Thousand, it was like one of these things, like the shows were incredible. The tours were incredible. I mean, it's every, if you were into hardcore music, it was like a dream come true as a fan. But it's sort of like, I already did that with Youth of Today. And I already did that with Shelter, practically. And now I'm doing it again. I just felt like, not that there was anything wrong with it, but I just felt like, been here, done this. I need to move on to my next phase of my life. And it took me a while to figure what that was out, too. Because, like I said before, I traded in that part time of my university and just studied, like living in an ashram. So what I ended up doing was I just got really serious into yoga and really serious into jujitsu. And that became both of those became my passion. And I was sort of winding down from doing music. I did a few more Shelter records and then I sort of stopped doing it seriously.
What do you think, if you look back at it, like what's the legacy of a band like Better Than a Thousand? Or what's your legacy if you look at all your projects combined together?
Well, in terms of legacy, when I hear that word, I think of something. There's something very natural when it comes to musicians with legacy, is you're leaving a piece of your heart or your mind or your thoughts on vinyl or on CD or on digital audio. That when I think of legacy, I think of something we're going to leave to my children. Yeah, you could leave. This is what Dad was thinking about. This is what my grandfather was thinking about. This is what the topics of the day were like. This is what music sounded like in 1998. You know, and so for them, you're leaving a piece of your personality. It's almost like a time capsule, holding parts of your thoughts and your mind and your heart and the sound. You know, you're leaving that. And in that sense, it's like almost if a person's diary could like start to talk and move. And, you know, it's visual because you see you see videos or you see photographs. It's like a piece of art, but it's basically on, and especially for a person writing the lyrics or a person writing the music, it's a great way to document your life. And practically every song I've ever written, I can remember exactly where I wrote it, what instrument I wrote it on, and where I was in that time of my life.
So contrary to what you said earlier, you did write a diary, just in a different form.
Exactly. It was like an audible audio diary, an audio, big audio diary. That's what I call it. Big audio dynamite.
How does your family relate to that part of your personality?
You know, it's, my wife's been to a few shows, but she doesn't know so much about it. She's a civilian. I call them, people who are not into hardcore, I call them civilians. And my kids have been to a few shows, but they're civilians too. My son just got a turntable and I gave him, see, I didn't keep any of all the records I recorded. I never kept them. Like, I have no personal copies of my own records. I have a few, but not like a collection of them.
Some of them are worth a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever. It's sort of like photographs, you know. I love photographs, but eventually they end up, I'll be an old man, they're going to ship them away somewhere and put them in a storage container and then throw them out. So, yeah, it would be cool to see them all. I don't have them all. I have a few ones. I have my Violent Children record I put out when I was 16. I have a copy of Break Down the Walls. So I had some reissues came out. And I gave them to my son yesterday, who just bought a turntable, but he never like listened to us. He didn't really know the songs. And it was just sort of they don't know me as a singer of a band. Although we did a couple of reunion shows recently where we do some shows, and I invited them to a weekend we did, and they think it's cool.
That it's rocking out?
Yeah. I think it's cool. It's weird. I don't think they know how to digest it. Like, what is this? Like, because I don't listen to that type of music anymore. So they're like, and I'm a yoga teacher. I do kirtans. And, you know, our kirtans are pretty heavy and loud, but they're nothing like a stage diving. And so they can't, I don't know. I think it's a different sort of part of my personality. I'm still I'm still a very intense person, but, you know.
Because the way you described it early on, that at some point you had a conflict and you tried to figure out who you are, you know, between all those worlds that you talked about. But it seems like all those worlds came together a little better in the last few years, right? You still perform as a punk singer?
Yeah, I still perform as a punk singer, but it's a little bit of a stretch outside of my comfort zone, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, it's sort of like, because I don't see myself, when you're in a band like that, you sort of see yourself as a kid. I don't really see myself as a kid anymore. and truthfully, I think it has a problem with a lot of times people growing up. And I don't mean growing up in a good way, like I want to stay young till I die. I mean growing up in like a maturing of who your identity is in this world. I think there needs to be a type of maturing. And so that's one. You know, this sounds sort of like, might sound bad, but if I don't like to think of myself like I thought of myself as a kid. I like to think of myself as an adult living in an adult world with adult responsibilities, adult thoughts, adult behaviors.
I mean, that might be the downside, though, of your audio diaries, because that part of your personality or that reincarnation of yourself is there for people to see for the next 100 years, right? If somebody picks up Break Down the Walls, he sees that picture and he hears that music that you played and he reads those lyrics, and that might be the only facet of your personality he knows.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And he doesn't know like the Raghunath Kapo of today and hasn't talked to you about. So do you think that comes with weird expectations?
Whenever you're dealing with fans, you're dealing with people's crazy expectations of you, for sure, for sure. You're not allowed to be an individual. You're, you know, you're a archetype or something, and they try to hold you to an archetype forever. Forever. I'm 54 years old. You know, they want you to be and think and speak exactly like you did, you know, when you were 19 years old.
Yeah. Which is crazy, right? Like, who would do that to anybody else?
To anybody else.
Ian MacKay still has to talk about straight edge to this day.
Yeah, of course. And that's what happens to any, like, child celebrity probably anywhere. I'm sure if there's a child celebrity, like, I don't know, some American TV show where there were children and they're adults now, they still get asked about these children. That's just part of the energy of dealing with fame and popularity, especially at a certain timeline in your life. But I feel like the messages were important, and those messages, because the messages were important, they stand the test of time forever.
Do you have that kind of fan reaction from yoga people too? Is there like fame and super fandom there?
There is. There is, actually. Yeah, there is. It might even be worse.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Because if from the outside, it's a subculture, like everything. Like
it's every just like everything subculture. Else. Exactly. It's a subculture.
So I assume it comes with the same problems. Probably.
Yeah. The same upsides and the similar downsides. Yeah, for sure. Good analysis.
Would you do anything different in hindsight? Because referring to that song of yours, I Can't Change History, on a Shelter album, I saw you posted that song recently. Like, you are aware of the fact, obviously, that you can't change history. Is there anything you would do different if you look back at it?
You know, whenever I look back, retrospect, I'm very happy sort of like where I am right now and who I am. So in that sense, whatever got me to now, I'm okay with. Even sometimes you go north or you go south. But the real thing is, like, where are you right now? 20 years later, 10 years later, 30 years later, where are you now? Are you happy with the choices that you made that got you to here? So sometimes I was extremely, you know, I tend to work in extremes pretty much. So I think I wouldn't ask myself to do it any differently, truthfully. I'm happy where I am now, and all those things in retrospect brought me to where I am right now. Now I could think of different ways to tighten up my game now in a personal way, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, in your defense, it takes extreme personalities to push things that at that point in time seem extreme.
They seem extreme, just like the thing we said about smoking or vegetarianism. They weren't extreme. They seemed incredibly extreme. Now it's completely normal. It's in the conversation to talk about animal rights.
Yeah. So if you look back at it, I think you're excused.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me off the hook there. I appreciate it. Thank you, Oisy.
I think we pretty much covered everything. When cool. You said you don't remember anything, that's actually not true. Like,
I guess a few things jarred back in. I'd be interested to hear what the other guys say.
So Ken is like, he has a great memory, by the way. Like, he does. Very detailed.
Not only that, he saves everything. He saves every record, every flyer, every t-shirt. He's got closets loads of t-shirts.
Yeah, when we dug through the archives to get the discography together, you know, like, he had so much stuff. And then we reached out, you know, to the general public, and it's amazing how excited people were to contribute and how stoked they were.
Oh, really?
To hear about the band.
It's good to know. All right, let's do a show.
Because I don't know if you, in retrospect, because you spent time doing, you know, Shelter and Youth of the Day, obviously always pops up again. I don't know that if you personally realize how dear a lot of people hold Better Than a Thousand.
You know, I still am in contact with a lot of people, and sometimes you forget, but people remind you, thank you, that helped me at this time of my life. Or so. If it wasn't for like the fans or the listeners, you might just forget that. Was anyone into that stuff? But people still reach out to me and track me down. So in that sense, you know, recently I was on Joe Rogan. I get a lot of people from that. They're like, I can't believe you were on Joe Rogan. Your music meant so much to me when I was a teenager and it helped me. I was troubled with, you know, drug addiction, or it saved my brother's life. Or we were speaking about things that were very, very like, you know, they're important issues in your growth, you know, addiction, drugs, meat eating, lifestyle, positive mental attitude, spirituality. And those are not just like small topics. These are like major life changing things. So if a person opted into any of those things, it could have saved their life. So yeah, people still remember it in that regard. And not just remember it as like a good time you played at our club and you rocked out, but it's sort of like, I opted into that lifestyle. Thank you very much. And so in that sense, I felt like good work is done. Good work has been done. It's okay to die now.
I mean, that's probably the biggest compliment, right? If you touched somebody that close.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do you think you were always so interested in such existential questions? That's heavy topics for a young person, don't you think?
I have no idea, but that's what I was into at a young age.
Like, you didn't scream about your parents not allowing you to go out and say that?
That's what I was into at a young age. So, you know, it's
old soul.
You know, I guess a materialist would say something like, you know, you're just genetically programmed like that. A spiritualist would say from your previous life, you're picking up where you last left off. Who knows why, but that's sort of where I was at a young age.
Perfect. So I think that's the perfect time to wrap it up, actually. I know
Thanks, man. You're busy.
You need to get back to homeschooling.
Three kids homeschooling today.
All right. Then thank you very much for your time, Raghunath. And,
thanks, brother.
I'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure, brother. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for listening to the End Hits podcast. If you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please send us feedback, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, or give us a review. Stay safe and take care.